Hello and welcome back to Millennial. And I'm now here with, this is the final regular stream of tonight. The next one will be the Christmas card stream. I'm now here with Auntie Dem, also called, okay, you have a new thing now, but I'll let you introduce yourself. I'll just say that Auntie Dem is an old friend of mine. We've known each other for, since at least 2015. I remember talking to you when I was building the new computer, and that was in April 2015. I remember talking to you down in the living room up in Scotland. So we've been in touch for quite a long time, and he's a good guy. So, Auntie Dem, welcome to Millennial 8.
Hey, everybody. You guys missed my JF Garapi impression, which I inflicted on Woz when we first contacted. But trust me, you're not missing much.
Oh no, it was actually disarmingly convincing. At first, I didn't know. I thought there was some technical flaw going on, but no, it was endearing. So, Auntie Dem, do you want to introduce yourself briefly to the audience?
Hey, everybody. I've had a blog going for 10 years now at auntiedem.wordpress.com, and it's still there, even though I haven't added anything to it in a while. I'm on Gab. If you want to see me there at, what have I just changed it to? I've changed it to, drum roll please, while I futz around with this, Anno Domini Pubs, AnnoDominiPubs. So find me there on the Blab, and that's about it for the moment. I'm in blogging right when nobody's doing that anymore, and I'm not on Twitter right when everyone's getting back on Twitter. And
I would say that there is Substack. That's definitely breathing new life into the whole idea of blogging.
Yeah, I don't know if there's any life in it anymore. I'm just okay. Here's the thing. When Woz and I were talking about this appearance, moving up to it, he was like, "Come on, you gotta be cheerful and uplifting. It's Christmas." And I'm like, "Cheerful? If you guys are waiting for me to be cheerful and uplifting, you better just go and French kiss that 44 Magnum right now, because I'm not there, man. It's pretty depressing. But I'm, you know what, my friend, listen to me, my friend, Millennial Woz asked me to come here and be cheerful, so I'm going to be cheerful if it come hell or high water."
Thank you for making the effort. Maybe it'll be like Scrooge, where, you know, I somehow make you see that everything's okay, really.
Well, if you're talking about Scrooge, the Bill Murray movie, that one is great.
Yes, that is a good, that, yeah, I remember that. That I always remember the term rat bastard idiot from that film. I think he did that in between the Ghostbusters, like the one and two.
I would say the best Christmas Carol movie adaptation ever is still 1951, starring Alistair Sim. That is just beautiful.
So presumably you haven't seen The Muppet Christmas Carol.
Oh, I've seen... Dude, I'm a prime Generation X. Trust me, I've seen The Muppet Christmas Carol. And frankly, it's not even my favorite Muppets Christmas special. I'm still... I've been playing... The John Denver and the Muppets Christmas special for the past 3 days.
Hold on, I'm sure that I had some images from that film, but I can't see them in my movies folder. But anyway, I haven't seen the version that you refer to, but I do know the Muppet version very well, and it's delightful. One thing I would say about it is it opens with the opening credits come up over this incredible, I don't know how big this model set must have been. It must have been massive. And it's going over, the camera's sort of swooping over this, model set of London, in, you know, Victorian London. And it goes on and on and on throughout, I don't know, 3 minutes or something. It's incredible. But then the film itself is Michael Caine as Scrooge. And you've got a wee girl as the Ghost of Christmas Past. And then a big jolly guy as is it the Ghost of Christmas Present? I guess it would be. And then sort of Death figure as the Ghost of Christmas Future, if I recall correctly. But it is actually a lovely film. I watched it a few Christmases ago, along with Home Alone and I think Eyes Wide Shut, which is actually a Christmas film. You know, people forget that. So, well, why don't you tell us about the version with John Mills that you mentioned?
John Denver.
Oh, sorry, John Denver.
Well, you know, it's just one of those things where if you grew up at the right time, it just hits all of those nostalgia buttons for you. I mean, I think it was produced in 77 or 78. And for me, you know, I know, especially since Stranger Things came on the air, everybody's on this big thing about, oh, the 80s were fantastic. They were wonderful. They were, you know, it's new height of America. And yeah, they probably were. Just not for me, because just personally, you know, my family was falling apart. Things were just awful. For me, that period that hits my nostalgia buttons is right, like, 1977 to 82. And anything from there. Like, the 70s are my warm, fuzzy, happy time.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute. But first, let me show you some random photos from my 1980s folder. And you can tell me whether you recognize this as the 80s. Here's one.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Hold on a second. Shopping malls. You have talked about shopping malls in the past. Were a big part of your childhood and adolescence.
Yeah, it's where I was growing up. It was the Paramus Park Mall, or maybe if you were feeling really upscale, you'd go over to the Garden State Plaza. But yeah, everything in that picture, the color schemes, the clothes, the hair. Yeah. Oh boy. That I remember that.
What year would you estimate that to be?
This would have to be 85, 86, maybe.
I think it was 88.
88, yeah. All right, I could see that.
Yeah, it's definitely not the early 80s. I mean, that's obvious. All right, here's another one.
Oh, boy. Holy cow. All right, I wasn't exactly in offices in the 80s, but, you know, one thing that I read somewhere is the number of college administrators, not faculty, not professors, administrators, has doubled since 1979, at the same point at which all this computerization technology has meant we probably need half as many administrators as we did in 1979. Because, you know, that allows you to do your job so much more efficiently and effectively. If you look at, you know, which means we probably have 75% more college administrators than we actually need. And I would bet that's actually honestly true in a lot of places. You know, during COVID, we sent most of the workforce home and things pretty much just kept on trucking.
Yes, this was a very interesting part of it, wasn't it? It sort of revealed that a lot of what goes on in daily life is bullshit.
Yeah, it's bullshit jobs. It's that nobody needs. You know, if you look back on like popular mechanics magazines from the 50s, they were saying, well, you know, in the future, increases in efficiency will mean everybody will be working a 3-day work week. Well, all those increases in efficiency and more showed up. And instead, we've got, you know, half the population working 60-hour weeks and the other half sitting at home on the couch in front of the Xbox. So, you know, it's not just a matter of technology. It's knowing what to do with it, knowing what makes a healthy society.
Yes. Do you like the general aesthetic of this image?
I like the furniture. I like the clothes. You know, people used to dress a lot. And you know, look, you talk about the ultimate house, glass house that I'm in no position to throw stones in. I mean, I think it's been like 5 years since I had a necktie on. But, you know, people did used to dress a lot nicer.
Yeah, you're into cravats and bow ties nowadays, aren't you?
Yeah, baby. Check out my frilly cravat. Where's Dr. Evil?
Here's another. I do like this in a way. It's kind of like the same way that I like brutalist architecture. I don't like it in real life, but it's nice to look at. You know, it's nice as an idea. It's nice as an image. It's kind of cool. It's interesting. But obviously, in real life, people shouldn't live like this. I mean, that's just obvious. So here's another random 80s image.
Yeah, again, you know, people obviously dressed nicer than they are now. And, you know, let's see, what's the date on that? Can you find one? 1988?
I think it is, yes.
And I guess people were looking forward to the future even in Romania.
Yeah. Which... Well, I mean, why wouldn't you look forward to the future if it had babes like that in it?
Yeah, actually, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, here's another one. The more Americana 80s.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
I bet that brings back some memories.
Well, again, it's when people used to care more about how they presented themselves. You know, people these days, and I, you know, they say that you really start feeling old when you realize that the world that you were raised to live in doesn't quite exactly exist anymore. And, you know, I keep falling into that more and more these days.
So do I, actually.
Partly with technology, but also, you know, and it was even not so much until COVID hit. And I think it's going to be a long time before we really understand how deep the effects of COVID were, and how many tentacles of society they spread to. Stuff like church attendance has plummeted since COVID and hasn't recovered. But I don't even think it's just that. It's people are such shut-ins these days. I mean, you know, they'll work from home. Then they'll go over to the couch and watch some Netflix. They'll order some DoorDash. And, you know, people, like, don't go out.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that's a thing. But what I wanted to bring up about this image is how you can tell that life was... I mean, there are always going to be the mean girls at school, at high school and all that. But here you've got an image of, like, each of those girls knows that all she has to do, her purpose at this point in her life, is just to be a hot bitch and just get a good guy, get the best guy you can find, and then settle down. And that's what they're raised for. It's what they're optimized for. And it worked in a way that, I mean, compare that with now, you know, some disaster, you know, I'm gender binary, non-fluid, you know, God knows what I am. And I don't know what to do with my life. I mean, even this image here, shallow though it is, bitchy though they no doubt were, it's still healthier than today.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this got brought up the other day. I was sharing with someone, there's an old Elton John song called Nikita from the mid-80s. And it's about this boy who falls in love with a girl on the other side of the Berlin Wall. And, you know, keeps looking across the wall at her and wondering if she notices him. And, you know, part of the conversation was me realizing, you know, things really were better back in the days when communists had the decency to build a wall to separate themselves from all the rest of the decent people out there. Can we have that back?
Yes, indeed. There's so much that could be said there, but let's just move on with another. I've got six more of these images, or seven more. I want you just to briefly comment on each one. Here's a more amusing one.
All right, I'll be taking my Vought, what is it, the Vought Kampf test? You see a turtle lying upside down on the sidewalk.
There's a hot 80s bitch. She needs your help. Anyway, what about this one? Was this your 80s? This is 85?
By the way, what's with the sun and rad in the background?
I didn't actually notice that.
Maybe did some flashy guy add that?
I'll take this out. I didn't realize that was there. I've literally never noticed that. I've had this in my 80s image folder. Okay, I'll take it out. Sorry about that, everyone. I'm sorry if that shocked anyone. I thought it was a fucking genuine 80s magazine. Anyway, here's another one. Was this your 80s?
Not quite. The guy in the silver quilted suit. That looks like something that Doc Brown would dress Marty McFly in to send him to 2022. You know, Marty, in the future, everyone will be wearing this.
Yeah, I know. It is hilarious. But even the other two, I mean, that guy, the other guy, what the fuck? And it looks like he's wearing Wellington boots or something. But yeah, obviously the silver guy is the main guy. He's the hot shot here.
I mean, the other two look like they just got off their shift at Chernobyl.
Exactly, whereas he looks like he just got off his shift at Thunderbird 5 or something.
Hey, I resent that. The Thunderbirds never dressed that gaudy.
I know. I'm so maybe Blake 7, the Liberator. All right, here's another one, more recognizable, I think.
Oh, I am actually in the middle of a rewatch of Miami Vice. About halfway through the first season.
And what's it like? I've never watched it.
Oh, gosh, you should. I mean, it still holds up as a drama for the most part, especially like the right. I mean, most shows hit their stride, you know, season 2, 3, 4, and then kind of start declining a little bit. That's sort of what happened to Miami Vice. And it's this weird combination of things where, on the one hand, I mean, the fashions are obviously very dated. The music.
Well, yeah, I see. Can I just say this? Of course, it's fucking dated. It's 40 years. I mean, I hate it when people say, "Oh, it's really dated now." Of course, it's fucking dated. That's the whole point. Sorry, I know that you weren't saying that because I know that you're not averse to, you know, vintage things and whatever. But it really, I think that word should be banned.
All right, I got a counterpoint for you. There was a point at which every decade had a very distinctive style.
Oh, yes, I've been making this point forever. It stopped. I know,
yeah,
I know.
Yeah, it stopped right around the turn of the century. I mean, when was the last time there was anything really new in rock music? Maybe like new metal around like 2002, 2003, you know, or that whole, you know, Slipknot sound, you know, whole Amy Lee thing right around the same time. When was the last time fashions really changed?
You know, I know. Like I said this to someone on my stream the other day. Let me see if I can find these images for you, because I think this is amazing. Right? I'll just show you this as to prove your point. And it's quite remarkable. Hold on a minute. Let me just see this. You keep talking and I'll find this for you.
Yeah, I mean, look around you. Is there anything that you are hearing on the radio, if people still listen to that, or Spotify or whatever you use, that couldn't have been a song out of 20 years ago? Is there anything that you see people wearing? Even, you know, hairstyles, clothes, shoes, anything that people couldn't have been walking around in 1998. Really, no. And it brings up a question of why? You know, why are we not able to produce anything new? you know, I'm not sure even I know, but I know whatever the answer is, it's probably pretty depressing. You know, at least I don't have to deal with that aspect of, you know, being old and cranky about what people are wearing. But still, you know, again, you can look at this picture and nail within 2 or 3 years when this is from, right? Okay, we're looking at Don Johnson in the jacket and all that. This is 1984 plus or minus 2 or 3 years. Just like that picture in the mall was 1985 plus or minus 2 or 3. Other than maybe video quality with the whole, you know, switch from digital from analog, you could barely look at anything these days and tell where it was within 20 years. But anyhow, did you have something you were bringing up?
Oh, I can't find the bloody images. It's really annoying, but it doesn't really matter. I guess the point was, it was four photos of a similar situation, which was a room full of computers. And I had one that was obviously from the 70s, one that was obviously from the 80s, one that was obviously the late 90s because it was the first iMac. And then I had one that, frankly, it could have been 2003, could have been 2009,
yep.
Could have been 2018, could have been 2022, and you would have no idea.
Well, you know, Oswald Spengler brought up the idea that a certain civilization will reach first its cultural height, where it's producing the maximum of cultural items, manners, clothing, music, art, literature, so on. But then it has a secondary height, which is the height, what he called the height of its civilizational phase, which is the height of its money, its power, its influence, and all of that. Now, within that, each culture can only produce, each kind of artistic impression could only be produced by a certain culture. And other cultures can imitate it, but they can't really produce it. And that goes across geography and it goes across time. So we could say, you know, well, we could reproduce, you know, Greek statuary. Yeah, we can. We can make a copy of it, but we can't really produce it ourselves naturally. And what that also means is we can't really add to the art form. Why did we stop producing classical music, basically? You know, if you force someone really talented to produce a symphony now, they could do it, but it would be more or less a copy of ideas from 300 years ago. You know, same way if you told someone that they told an American they have to produce a no drama or a kabuki play, they can do it. It'll be a copy of foreign ideas, and they can't really innovate in it, especially the way that someone from that culture would. So I'm running on a thesis that rock music was a unique cultural product of the Anglosphere in the late 20th century. That with the notable exception of Nordics and heavy metal, nobody outside of the Anglosphere has really produced any rock music. Pop, sure, but not rock. And that the ability to produce rock kind of petered out right about the year 2000. And now we're just running on the fumes of old ideas from the 80s, 90s, and so on. I don't know. What do you think of that?
Well, definitely. I mean, I've actually found it now. So I can actually, I was going to give up on it, but here it is. So here's the 70s.
Yeah.
And here is the 80s. Hold on. There we go. Right. And this is obviously the late 90s for anyone who can remember that era. And then, and I remember that being really cool at the time. You know, like, wow, that this is so new and everything is inside the monitor and all that. It was very nice. And then this. Now, this is flat screens. And as soon as the flat screens arrive, that's it. And really, I don't know when that's from. I have no idea if that's from, as I said, 2004, 2009, 2013, 2019, anything. I find that quite incredible. So yeah, that's just making your point for you. Sorry. Go on.
Here's a picture. I'm going to send this to you in the private chat. Of Margaret Hamilton, not the actress who played the Wicked Witch of the West, another woman with the same name who was one of the early computer programmers and wrote a lot of the code for the Apollo missions. And there's this picture of her standing next to a printout of all of her code, which is about 6 inches taller than, they're about the same height. And notice how she's dressed in that, you know, boy, you can tell, right, okay, that's 1968 to 72 right there, right? Yeah, that, you definitely. know, uh, uh, that Jan Brady dress and the hairstyle, you know, everything. Yep, that is an era right there.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, well, return to the 80s images just for the sake of it. Here's one that I quite like, because I can remember places like this from my early childhood. The pool table, or I can't remember if it's snooker or pool, and it's a games room sort of area. There'll be people smoking. There'll be arcade machines. There'll be a bar. Your dad will go to the bar. You know, this... And there'll be other kids to talk to. You know, it was, these were nice places. And I'm sure that there were very close equivalents of them in America.
Did you ever watch Spaced?
I've seen a few episodes of it. It was all right. It wasn't quite my kind of thing. But yeah, it was funny.
Reminds me of the scene with Brian in the pub and Come On Eileen from the early 80s.
Right. Okay, I haven't seen that. Gosh, that must be weird, because I guess they would be about that. Yeah, okay. Then here's another one from the 80s, a completely different thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, going back to the pool table one, you know, that's what I was talking about. It's the whole bowling alone thing with, you know, people not getting out and socializing like they used to. And there's a lot behind that. I think, you know, one of the effects of too much diversity is people don't feel comfortable being out. You know, if you notice, there's sort of something all the same about the people in this photograph.
Yeah, I haven't even thought of that. You know, I guess for someone younger than us, someone a teenager or 20s, when they see a photo like that, it might actually strike them as, oh,
yeah.
That's strange, kind of thing.
And, you know, it's, I mean, people like being around their people who they perceive to be like themselves. That is just part of human nature. It doesn't matter whether it's a good part or a bad part. It's a part. So that's part of it. I think the increase in crime that we've seen, especially in the post-2020 era, people don't want to go out as much. I think the economic squeeze we're being put in, people don't have the amount of disposable income that they used to have. And I think people are just, I think people are less prepared to be social than they used to be.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, it's harder for people to make friends. I think there is definitely something behind what seems to be a hockey stick curve in rates of autism. I remember in 1988 going to see Rain Man with my dad.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Like at the time, nobody knew what autism was. Like, it was such a rare thing that nobody, you know, this was, you know, it was like a movie about AIDS in 1982. Like, oh, here's this new thing we have to tell you about. You know, now, I mean, it's so common. There's got to be something behind it. And I don't know whether that's, you know, plastic bottles like this one that I'm drinking out of right now, or, you know, something in the air. But, you know, there's that. People are just increasingly becoming shut-ins these days.
Oh, yeah. Here's another image from the 80s, which I think I liked it because, it sort of reminded me of my early childhood and how I saw older kids then. I think it's from about 1985 or 86. And it's a bunch of kids at some skating rink, I think. And I don't know. I think I was Googling like 1985 and just seeing what came up. And it's nice. It's funny to do that, because you see things that are quite surprising like this. But again, you've got this sense of, I'm sorry to say it, but I mean, everyone looks happy and carefree, and it just seems like a much less corrupt time.
There's a movie that I have been meaning for years to try to talk you into seeing so that we could do some kind of little review of it together. It's called Melody. It's from 1971.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very much an England that just doesn't quite exist anymore.
Yeah. This is 85, you know. These kids would have been, because I can remember, vaguely remember kids dressing like this. It's amazing to think of now. But sorry, it's about Melody. Sorry I interrupted you there.
No, you know, it's, yeah. That's another thing, too, that the internet age has done, is that up until 15 years ago, Europeans still dressed like Europeans. They didn't all dress like Americans.
Yes, that's true.
If you went to Italy or to France or someplace like that, even into Eastern Europe, they weren't walking around in Lululemon leggings and, you know, Coca-Cola t-shirts and all of that. It's almost like, you know, it's like the internet has been a Gresham's law of culture.
Yes.
Pushing all the, you know, with all the worst pushing out the best.
Yeah, absolutely. We can return to that in a minute. Let me just show you these other images from the 70s. From the 80s. Again, I can remember seeing things like this in magazines. This is the start of the corporatization. It's the technology. There's a sense of the future. And yet, at the same time, it's clearly old. It's not from now.
Talking about memories of being an old school anime fan back in the 90s, before anything was distributed digitally, you know, everybody who was in those circles would have like half a dozen VCRs in their house.
I know a slogan that was used at the time.
Yeah.
Because it's used in The Fly, the Jeff Goldblum film. He says, is it live or is it Memorex?
Well, you know, you could always tell a 90s otaku's house because, yeah, like half a dozen VCRs, two or three TV sets, and just piles and piles of 10 packs of VHS tapes. And if you wanted to make copies of anime soundtracks for people, of cassette tapes just like this, and there would always be something copying for somebody, right? You'd wake up in the middle of the night to take a whiz, go over to the VCR, okay, take this tape out, put that tape in, click, click, there you go. Now, my general purpose...
This is another image from my 80s folder. These are all from my 80s folder, so there you go.
I would say this would probably be more 90s. Maxels...
I think that's late 80s. Maybe the one at the bottom... Yeah, definitely that bottom left. That's definitely the 90s.
Okay, guys would have their own choice of their go-to standard tape to copy onto. Now, on the one hand, you didn't want to stiff your friends by giving them an absolute bottom-of-the-line tape. On the other hand, that could add up. So a lot of guys went with the Sony V down here on the lower left. My personal go-to tape was the Maxell Silver. That hit the right point for me, but if I could find the Sony V's on sale, I'd get those too. And like I said, you go in, get a 10 pack or two, cause you were going to go through them fast, but you know, you copied things for people. They copied things for you. It went back and forth, so on and so forth. I mean, I guess it's better now with Crunchyroll, but that's another thing. It's not social like it used to be.
Everything has lost its specialness. I mean, on the one hand, it's very useful to be able to just copy a link, send it to someone, and that's it. They've got that video. They can see it on YouTube or wherever, or whatever it is. But on the other hand, it makes everything less special. I mean, it's just a thing. And I was talking about this before with record stores. It used to be really fun to just wander around them. Secondhand record shops, it was a really nice thing to go in there. I mean, it's just something we've lost. I'm not sure what's going to happen. It's sad that young people today and, you know, forthcoming generations simply will not have this experience. I don't know. And that's the question. You know, on the one hand, well, things change. Something goes, but there'll be other special things in future. But what? that's the question. Like, what will be special? Like, how will people experience specialness in the future when everything is abundant? I mean, well, you know, then again, Ukraine, Nord Stream, the energy shortages. Maybe things won't be. Maybe media will be abundant with the internet, but other things won't be. I'm not sure.
Well, you know, there's that certain joy of having a holy grail item that you've been after for a couple of years. And all of a sudden, you know, you walk into some secondhand shop, you're looking through stacks of records, and, you know, you find it and you pull it out and it's great shape, and you look at the price sticker and it's like £3. It's like, wah, you know, I found it and this guy doesn't know what it's worth. Like, ah, you know, that feeling of victory walking out of there with this rare LP or, you know, this rare video cassette or whatever, you know, yeah, that's gone. And that whole, you know, horse trading thing of, you know, you go to an anime club and you talk to, hey, do you have a copy of episode 4 through 8 of, you know, the new Ranma? Oh, yeah, okay, okay. All right, how would you like, I'll trade you this for it. Okay. You know, yeah, again, the social aspect is all gone. It, you know, social media is the only social thing we've got anymore.
Yeah. And even that has been toxicified with, you know, Instagram and all the shittiness. Here's one more 80s image. There are only two more, don't worry. And then we'll go to the 70s. Here's one. Yeah. I like this because, again, I remember this sort of design aesthetic. You'd see it in department stores. You'd see it on TV. And frankly, I like it. I actually just objectively like this. I know it's not homely or cozy, and I do have other photos of similar things like, which are much more cozy than this. But at the same time, I do like this. What do you think, Andy Dem?
You got me looking for something because I have always been a fan of Patrick Nagel. And as soon as I'm looking for a picture to show you that is PG for the family, because, you know, we're that kind of stream right here. But as soon as you see Nagel, you'll recognize his art style. Yeah, here we go.
Okay, if he's... I don't know if you can here put we go. Images. Go for it.
Oh, I just posted a link in the...
All right, hold on a second.
He did a couple.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay.
He did a couple of album covers for Duran Duran back in the 80s, and that's probably where most people would know that art style for. But it's very similar to what you're showing, that whole very linear, you know, line art style.
I'm trying to get it up for on the screen for people. Here it is, coming up now. And it is absolutely iconic of the 80s. Here we go.
I mean, it's very 80s iconic. It's very 20th century. It does call back a lot to Aubrey Beardsley, right around the turn of the 20th. But yeah, that is unmistakably... And again, I think most people who were around at the time would look at that and know instantly what it is, if not who created it.
Definitely. Yeah, it's lovely. And it reminds me of a lot of album covers. you'd see this sort of look. It's very nice. I like it. There was one I had in my 80s folder that was similar, but I can't see it now and it'll take too long. But yeah, lovely. Here's one more. You reminded me of this one, which, and I put this up on Telegram and said, the boomer in his prime, because this is obviously a mid-80s, early 80s. And he's probably a guy in his 30s. He is a boomer. That is, you know, the people who are now in their 60s and 70s, that's them. That's his generation, which is a nice image. And then the final 80s image that I wanted you to comment on is this one, which is rather jokey. And, you know, the thing here, this is Arnie in the film Commando, which I've seen once, and it is hilarious. Not least because his character name in this film is John Matrix. And who the fuck is Cole? Is that an actual surname in America?
No, it is not.
Right, okay.
Yeah, but, you know, when was the last time you saw a movie like that? It's hard to think of one, especially hard to think of one that's not a remake of a movie from 40 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This is a thing. You know, like even Death Wish, for example, that was remade recently with, I think, Bruce Willis. And, you know, it's... I haven't seen it, so I don't know. But the point is that it's a remake of a film from, I think, 1974 or 5 yeah. with Charles Bronson. And there were several others, remakes of 80s films. It's a thing. It's like we can only have masculinity, and this obviously is a rather overblown masculinity, but we can only have it if it's some sort of retro or ironic thing.
Well, I mean, Hollywood is just so out of ideas. I mean, and I don't see what's going to save it. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was actually a really interesting movie because it was Tarantino, who grew up in Hollywood in the late 60s, reflecting on an era when the old Hollywood faded away and you just had the first beginnings of the new auteur Hollywood of, you know, Spielberg, Lucas, Coppola, so on and so forth. Now, because, you know, the Hollywood of the old studio system before that had just run out of gas. It run out of creative energy. But now we've got the new Hollywood, which finally, after 50 years, has totally run out of creative energy. And I don't think anything new is coming in to save it.
You know. Well, that's the question, isn't it? I mean, I think that Marvel, the superhero films, seem to signal the end of Hollywood. And you know, maybe they won't. Maybe it will limp on for another few years. I'm sure it will. But the fact that they're making something like this, the fact that they're making, and I should take the Commando image off because people will think I'm referring to that. The fact that they're making something like these god awful superhero films, I think signals that they're just out of. They're sort of giving up. It's just, in a sense, it's just bullshit. And everyone must know it. Everyone must know that every fucking one of these films is the same. It's garbage. It's empty. There's no originality. There's no substance. It's crap in a deep way.
Yeah, Endgame pretty much was.
Well, I mean, I don't know what Endgame is. What are you referring to then?
Avengers Endgame, the superhero movie.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, it's not my kind of thing. So I'm not. I see clips from it, from these things. I see the posters and the adverts and whatever. But I've never. I think the last I actually did watch the. What was that one that came out in like 2000? The fuck was it? I can't remember, but I saw the first one. It was the one with Magneto in it. You know, Patrick
Stewart. Oh, the
X-Men. Yeah, I saw the first X-Men film at the cinema. And, you know, I don't know what I thought about it at the time. Probably didn't like it. It would have been, you know, I would have been quite haughty about it. And rightly. But, you know, that was the only one I ever watched. And now it just seems to be that they're churning them out and they've got huge budgets. They're spending fortunes. And actually an interesting example, not exactly the same thing, but a similar thing, is James Cameron's new Avatar film, which seems to be not doing well, which I find very interesting.
Well, he left the property sitting for 13 years. I mean, yeah, you know, you got to keep people's interest up somehow. And also, we're not in the same place politically or socially that we were in 2009. You know, one of the things is, just as culture seems to be slowing down to a crawl, politics is just going at this breakneck pace, so that the issues that seem important now didn't even exist a few years ago. And all the issues that seem super important, you know, 10, 15 years ago, don't mean anything now. You know, remember when Islam was like this huge civilizational threat to us, and we had to have this like defining Ragnarok, you know, civilizational clash with them, and how that just like disappeared one day.
Yeah.
You know, 2009, yeah. The Iraq War was still going on. People were really concerned with things like, you know, imperialism and, you know, overstretch and all of that. Now it's like, well, okay, that's all gone. You know, we're on to completely other things.
Yeah. Well, part of that is the woke stuff, but then also the arrival of technocracy, in a sense. But then also the Russia has returned, as it reemerged as the big bad, as it was in the 80s. Well, in your memory, obviously it goes back further than that. Would you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, it's, you know, back in the 60s, when Muhammad Ali was drafted to go to the Vietnam War, he refused to go. And when someone asked him why, he said, "No Vietnamese ever called me and I'll be nice and not get you banned, but you know what the word is." Yeah. Well, you know what? No Russian ever called me a racist, sexist, bigot, homophobe, you know, insurrectionist.
Transphobe.
Transphobe, you know, yeah, okay. So, hey, somebody wants to go fight Russia, you can strap on an AK-47 and you go make yourself happy, bro. But they're not my enemy.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people feel this way. But I guess the job of government is to make people hate the enemy in some way. So you'll get this, you know, the Muslims are blowing us up. They could strike at any time. And every plane, every flight is a risk. And yet we'll keep bringing them into our societies in ever greater numbers, which is completely insane.
Yeah. You know, and again, it was just another, you know, meme that the powers that be pushed on us to get us to do what they wanted us to do and to give them more money and power. You know, you ever notice how these bums never end up with a problem that involves giving them less money and power?
Yeah.
I mean, surely you'd think there'd be at least one.
That is an amazing idea. Let's return now to...
well, hold on a second. One more thing. Well, I sent you one more link for another Nagel painting. And this I hope it's not too spicy for the screen, but there's a point I want to make about it.
Right. Hold on a second. All right. Is it how porcelain her skin is? How athletic
no.
frame? Okay. Here it is.
Okay. So here it is, and I want you to notice something about this. This artwork is erotic. It is not pornographic. And it comes from the last age, I think, really the 80s, where you had something that was erotic but not pornographic. And I think in many ways, the age of universally available pornography has really destroyed the erotic.
Yes.
You know, you can't have something like this or like Gil Evgren or, you know, the World War II nose art or something like that. Something erotic but not crude, not pornographic, not explicit. We lost something when we lost this. And I know, you know, I'm supposed to be Mr. Tradcast. It's supposed to be point at this and go like, you know, oh, this is as dirty as anything else, throw it in the fire. No, not really. I mean, I think, this is something that should be not available to little children, but at the same time, there is still an artistry to this. There is still a humanness to this. There is still a playfulness to this that, you know, I think puts this on the side of genuine art. And I think, again, it's just been squeezed out. You know, Playboy itself, and Nagel did a lot of work for Playboy, did a lot of art for them. In fact, the poor guy died of a heart attack. He went to the Playboy mansion ran a half marathon with the Playboy Playmates and collapsed and died of a heart attack.
No, I guess there are worse ways to go.
Yeah, well, yeah. But, you know, Playboy is going out of business because the level of eroticism it has is too much for an SFW and not enough to reach modern tastes. You know, we're like an alcoholic where, you know, drinking two beers will make you or me lightheaded. Drinking two or three beers, they won't even notice it.
Yeah.
You know, we've increased our tolerance so much that, you know, something has been lost. And this is one of those things that's been lost.
Oh, you know, completely. Sorry to interrupt you. Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think our sense of taste has been coarsened and bluntened at the same time in this way, and it's crap. But more optimistically, or nostalgically, let's return to your golden age of the 70s, and I'll present you with some random images from that decade for you to comment upon. Here is a set of tins of food.
Well, okay, this is all British, so I didn't see any of this. Right. So this is Tesco, Sainsbury's, and...
Yeah, but you can guess the era. I'm sure the graphic design would have been similar across the pond.
Oh, yeah, this will be right there in the background of Only Fools and Horses.
Yeah. Well, the early season. Yeah, yeah. I think it's lovely. You know, this is before my time, obviously, but I remember, like, for example, my grandmother having tins of, like, it looked like this in the larder of things that wouldn't perish, I guess, or things that she'd meant to throw out 10 years ago but had forgotten to. It was cozy. It was lovely. All right, I'll give you another one. This is some chocolate bars.
Yeah, it'll be in Hyacinth Bucket's kitchen.
Fry's 5 Center, which I believe was discontinued in the early 90s. I don't remember it at all. Again, this is British. You can see, I think that last, the third one is probably 90s. But the other two, that, oof, I mean, what would you guess there? I think the second one is 70s. The first one, I'd say that's 60s, maybe.
Well, I mean, there's good news and bad news. The good news, I think bad news and bad news. The bad news is we're never going back to London in the 70s. The other bad news is we may be going back to Belfast in the 70s. That may be coming soon.
Well, yes. Yes, that is rather depressing. All right. Here's another one. This is cozy. These are soup mugs or soup bowls.
There was someone posted on, I think, Gab a little while ago, a picture of a living room that was clearly from the 70s with all the decor in it. And the caption was, anyone who was a kid in that era knows exactly what this room smells like. I'm like, yep. That is cigarette smoke dug into every last little tiny patch in that room. Yeah.
Mm. It's lovely. I like that very much. I have others from a similar era. Here's an amusing magazine advert. As you can see, completely misogynistic.
Yeah. But, of course, effective. And it's stuff that was antisocial by 70s standards now seems oddly pro-social, you know.
Oh, yeah.
At least
they're
trying to teach you to be Mr. Macho dude there.
Yeah, be the alpha male and get loads of chicks fancying you. I mean, it's a thing. And the thing is, it's a weird thing because I think, obviously, alpha males still exist. Obviously, women still gravitate to powerful men and attractive men and confident men and arrogant men and talented men. And yet men are constantly denigrated and discouraged from being that. And women are constantly discouraged from doing that.
Well, there's a couple of things here. I mean, being serious for a minute, this is a good example of the Pareto distribution that came about from the sexual revolution, where, you know, all of the women gravitated towards the top 20% of men, leaving the bottom 80% with severely diminished prospects, unless they wanted to wait around until some of those women turned 35, hit the wall, were running out of eggs, and finally decided to settle down. You know, alpha F's, beta bucks, as the story goes. So, I mean, in a way, it's a really bad thing, but I don't think they were thinking that far ahead in, was that 1973 on the bottom there? So,
Yes, I think that is. But let me see. I'll see if I can find it. I think it's the early 70s. I don't think it's, yeah, let's see. Yeah, 73. Yeah. So, okay, that's that one. Here is a supermarket.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, okay, there's good. By the way, everyone, welcome to, you know, the I'm sure you've been listening to Millennial this whole month and hearing people talk about, you know, weighty philosophical and demographic and religious issues. And now here it is Christmas Eve and it's two old dudes, you know, mooning for the 70s. Sorry.
Come on, we're not that fucking old. I wouldn't say old, but whatever. We're not spring chickens either.
It's the Millennial Yule Nostalgia Hour. Starring him and someone even older. Freaking Statler and Waldorf.
It is nice. Now, again, this is before my time. I don't think I even saw things like this in a dilapidated state 10 years later. I think they'd all been, you know, pulled out and replaced. But even so, it's cozy.
Yeah, yeah. And there was some of that everywhere. I mean, there's this. I remember in the late 90s, when I lived in Japan, finding the last few of the old school Japanese shopping malls, the big vertical ones that would have been around in the 60s and 70s before the very last of them got torn down. And that had a sort of, even though I wasn't part of that Japanese culture in the 60s, 70s, 80s, I could still appreciate that I was seeing something that was kind of the last of its kind. And it had that same coziness to it that this does. Now, of course, the bad part of this is standing behind five different housewives as they all struggle to write checks, you know, to pay to the order of.
Oh, my God.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Here is a different one, quite amusing.
Okay. All right. We got to talk.
Come on, it's just random images. I think they're quite funny. Here's another one. This is more.
Well, hold on. What I'm saying here is the only way that this is excusable is if you currently reside in Bermuda. If you live, maybe even Jamaica. If you're one of those last English holdouts living there, I can see this. But otherwise, no. It's kind of like the man bun. You know, the rule with the man bun is you're allowed to have a man bun only if you are currently carrying a samurai sword.
Yes, and I agree. That's a good rule of thumb there. All right, we'll move on to a more perhaps thought-provoking image. I like this. It's an advert for a brutalist estate that was new in the 70s in London called the Barbican, which I have visited once. I think there was some sort of exhibition going on anyway, whatever, it's a long time ago. So yeah, and it has various facilities, including a private school, but also a conference center, all this kind of stuff, and also accommodation, living accommodation for people. And it's actually remained very popular. The Barbican is one of the only two brutalist places that I know of in London for which there is great fondness. The other one being Alexander Road in Camden. And I'll put up another photo of the Barbican just so that people know what kind of thing I'm talking about.
I think you and I may be the only people in the whole world who genuinely mourn the passing of Thamesmead.
That's the Barbican, concrete, and yet it's well preserved because for some reason, a lot of people have a lot of fondness for it. So it's one of these things that has really survived the ages, at least so far.
I mean, you and I look at this, and the first thing we think of is a background from the 1979 Buck Rogers in the 25th century, or maybe Logan's Run. But
I mean, I can show Thamesmead as well if you want to go the whole thing. You know,
Thamesmead.
Do you want to go there?
So Thamesmead, most people think of it as being in the background of A Clockwork Orange. There's also a BBC TV show from the mid-zeros called Misfits.
Oh, yes.
That was set in Thamesmead.
This is Thamesmead. This is the housing, one of the housing blocks. This actually, as far as I know, this bit does still survive. The rest of it has been demolished.
I strongly believe that even ugly things deserve preservation. You know, like, yeah, I understand that you can't save all of it, and you shouldn't necessarily save all of it. But there should be preservation of at least a few, you know, really exemplary examples of it. And I think the push to tear down all the brutalism is very misguided. I think a lot of it should go, but we should have a serious conversation about what should stay.
Yeah, I would agree. That last shot I put up is awful. I apologize for that one. But, it showed it in a very dilapidated state. But actually, I can show you, I did put together some comparisons. This is interesting. Yeah. I'll show you this just now. Hold on. The photo that's up just now is from the famous scene in A Clockwork Orange, where they're
I think every scene in A Clockwork Orange is infamous.
Well, yes, but this is sort of iconic. The one where they're walking in slow motion alongside the lake, which is called Southmere Lake. It's artificial, obviously. So that's it. Again, the buildings on the right are all gone now, and in the background, they're all gone now as well. But here's a comparison image, which I think is very interesting. And this show, I've never been to this place. All of this was demolished in 2012, 2013. More fool me, you know, what a fucking idiot for not. I could have gone when I was living in London in the mid 2000s, but I never did. So I never got to see this place. It was a new town built in the mid and late 60s. Southeast London, and on marshland, interestingly, which created a lot of problems. But it was an attempt to, well, it was a new town. There were quite a few of them built in Britain around that time, and it was an attempt to build a new community with no history, no past, no buildings. Everything was new. To create it from scratch. And you can see what became of it. Rapidly. Now, at the start, it's a sunny day. This is a publicity shot that they've taken, trying to make it look appealing. And at first, I dare say there were some, you know, well-meaning, well-intentioned, respectable working-class people who took the offer to be transferred to a council house here. And probably if it had stayed with those people, it might have had a chance, but then the demographics, you know, other demographics were brought in. But also, I think this architecture does seem to have an effect on people. Basically, if you're at the Barbican and you're an upper middle class professional, it you can stand it and it's fine and you won't end up killing each other. But if you're working class, and I don't say this as a matter of snobbery, I just think it seems to be something that consistently happens. A working class community placed into an environment like this will become self-destructive. That's without the matter of multiculturalism. You know, just I think white working class people, I don't know what it is, but for whatever reason, this kind of environment seems to destroy them in a way that it doesn't, as I say, with the upper middle class. Don't know why, but anyway, so it starts off with this sunny day in the early 70s, and then it ends like this in the bottom image, where it's the same it's the same place, same buildings. The swing park, play park has been changed, obviously, over the years, probably several times. And that's just before it all got torn down. And that's in the space of like 45 years. Auntie Dem, have you fallen asleep while I've been talking about Thames?
Oh, I'm sorry. Right, okay. I pressed the dump button when I meant not to. There's definitely there's something to a humane environment. Something that speaks to the human soul and keeps us going. And there's something to unhealthy environments that just feel oppressive. You know, that living in that feels oppressive. It's the constant grayness of it. And of course, you know, the typical English weather can't help that at all. It feels cheap. It feels manufactured.
Soulless.
Soulless, like nobody cares about you.
Yeah.
Compare that to, the famous British row house of a generation or two before. And those are much, much more humane. People complained about them, but I don't think they know how good they had it.
Mm. Well, before we get to that, let me just show you this other comparison image of Thames Mead. I put this together back when I was obsessed with this stuff in 2013, just immediately before starting the Millennial Woes channel, actually. I went through about 6-7 months when I was just obsessed with this and gathering all these images. So here's another comparison from Thames Mead. As you can see, it's the very same building, very same street, almost the same angle. And, when it was new, it looked like something from Joe 90. When it was old, it looked like something from A Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
It's fucking dreadful. I mean, you can imagine. Oh God, it's just awful.
The problem with retrofuturism is people taking a guess at what the future is going to look like. It's always a gamble. And, you can be right on and ahead of your time, or you can be way off. I just put in the chat my favorite building of this type, which unfortunately is not there anymore, Volkskammer building, the Palast der Republik in East Berlin. So this was the East Berlin Parliament building. And I think it should have been kept. That's the interior. And then the link right above it is the exterior. And I think it definitely should have been kept around. Here, show them the interior. That's the link above the exterior. Yeah, there we go.
Sorry, I didn't see the first link. Yeah.
I think there is definitely something striking about this, something of its time, something that should have been preserved. They should have turned it into a museum or a concert hall or something, But I think in the myopia of being too close to the communist era, this being a symbol of oppression, people just wanted it gone. And I think that's what happens to a lot of, that's what happened to a lot of English country houses in the early 20th century. People saw them as symbols of an inequitable past and wanted them gone. I think it's what's happening to a lot of brutalism now. I think it's what's happening to a lot of Soviet realism in the East right now. And I think we would be much more well-advised to slow our roll and consider which of these needs preserving. Mm. And I really mourn that this is gone.
Yeah, I by the way, I've never seen so many Trabants in one picture before. That's incredible what they say about, behind the Iron Curtain and the prevalence of Trabant cars. But anyway, see, yeah, you gotta understand, I agree.
This is the Parliament building where all the highest executives of East Germany worked. So, like, literally everyone who could afford a Trabant is in that building. That's how communism worked.
Right. I mean, I think you're right that there are some examples of it absolutely should be preserved. And there are examples that I like. As I said, I quite like the Barbican. I quite like Alexander Road in Camden. I'll show a photo of that so that people know what we're talking about. Hold on a second. Wait there. It's more just for housing. And again, there's a tremendous amount of affection for it. I think here it is. Right. There we go. That's in London. And it's like something from Joe 90. It's quite amazing, actually. Joe 90 is my reference point for this stuff because I never liked Thunderbirds.
Speaking of the guy in the silver LeMay outfit, you know, that's what everyone in this is what everyone in 1963 thought the year 2000 would look like.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's a thing, isn't it? That this is how everyone will live one day. This is how everywhere will look. But the thing is, for a while, you know, certainly in my childhood in the 80s, a lot of buildings were concrete. It was kind of like the default. Here's that same place when it was new, incidentally. Same view. There it is. Amazing. So, yeah, there we go. But this is Alexander Road. So that's a thing. I mean, and as I say, it's still standing now while a lot of these places have been demolished. And I understand why someone could look at this and think, oh, my God, that's dreadful. It's hideous. But, you know, if you actually visit there, and I have visited there, it's actually really nice. It's actually and genuinely not even like as a bleak dystopia thing. It's like the layout, the architect clearly put a lot of effort into how people actually live, how they are, how they behave, what works for them, what doesn't. And it's actually very pleasant. Here's another one that perhaps shows the thing. Sorry, it's a crap quality photo. But anyway, there we go. So we got onto this, I think. Oh, yes, because of the Barbican. I was showing you this image and we got talking about all of this. So that's another image. Again, I quite like the font. I think that's called Windsor. And then another 70s image would be this. We had those at my primary school. It's a reading system. I think it was Canadian, actually. And then another is the more dark side of the 70s. I think this is the late 70s as the Cold War was heating up. There we go. This is about nuclear war. And, you know, it's scary. And I imagine that you have some memories of this. This era?
Well, the whole nuclear war thing, there was, what was that movie, The Day After?
That was the American one. The British one was called Threads, which was, everyone says, a lot better.
And there was one that I remember, I think it called Special Report. That was some kind of terrorist gets a hold of a nuclear bomb, and they have to find the guy and defuse it before it goes off. That one actually was pretty good as a drama. It's a little dated, especially because the guy, the villain, went on to be the guy who played Sledgehammer. But yeah, that's, you know, I guess we thought the Cold War was over, but no, because people could still make money off of selling weapons. So there you go.
So why don't you talk more optimistic? Well, first of all, I'll show this picture of British row houses, which are very nice, actually.
Similar to
Victorian terraced housing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, when I see this picture, the first thing that goes through my mind is, I look at all the lonely people.
Oh, yes.
I think, you know, the Beatles got it wrong. This represents a certain high point in Britain because, you know, it represents that point. I mean, we've all Friedrich Engels wasn't wrong when he described industrial era Manchester, you know, of 1844 or 45 as being absolutely hellaciously poverty stricken. Yes. You know, some of the awful, awful poverty you saw, the awful working conditions of the people in the factories, you know, for terrible pay. But one of the reasons that the communist revolution never took off in Britain like Marx and Engels thought it would was by the time you got to the end of the 19th century, things had improved tremendously for the workers. You know, the average worker was working an 8-hour, you know, 40 hours a week. He was getting decent pay. And, you know, he had a wife and a family, and he lived in some place like this.
Yeah, and sanitation was improving. Yeah. Everything was getting better, as far as I know, throughout the course of the 19th century in Britain, because there were multiple acts of Parliament that were specifically aimed to improve life in general for everyone.
Yeah, this is perfectly nice, perfectly comfortable, working class. There is absolutely nothing wrong with this. Which meant, of course, we had to come along and destroy it for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah, it's terrible. The early 20th century, like just for, I don't know, 10 years, 20 years, that there was a nice moment when we still made pleasant buildings. And then, yeah, I think from the 30s onwards, you get that horrible... I don't know what... I've forgotten the name for it now. Is it art? I don't think it's Art Deco, but I think Art Deco was okay, but it was the thing that came right after. I've forgotten the name. It's annoying.
Well, there's modernism, yeah. International style, Art Deco. And look, all of those can be very pleasant. I mean, if you ever watch the Hercule Poirot mysteries, the David Suchet ones.
Yeah, I've just Googled it. Yes, Art Deco. I'm afraid, I have to say, I don't like it. I'm sorry.
I still like that.
There's some weird interference coming in there. Oh, it's gone away now. Okay.
All right. Let me know, because sometimes these microphones.
Yeah, I think something might have changed. It's gone. It's very right. Distorted.
Hold on, just a sec. Okay. Be right back.
Okay. Thank you. I hope you're all enjoying this. He's left. He's going to come back in. So Dadaism, yeah, I'm afraid I just don't like Art Deco. I'm sorry. Art Nouveau, that's probably the one that I was thinking of that I do like. Let me see, Art Nouveau House. Let's see. Oh, yes. Yes, that's, oh, yes. I mean, it's a wee bit showy. You could say it's a bit too much, but, you know, it's a lot better than what followed, for sure. So, but I still think, you know, neo-Gothic, Victorian, I think it's just the best, consistently. But yeah, I don't mind this. I don't mind this at all, the Art Nouveau. Thank you for reminding me of that term. It wasn't coming to mind. Beaux Arts, yes. Yes, I like that as well. Let me just see. I saw a tower that was in New York that was of that. So, yeah, I mean, yes. I don't see how anyone could have... What? I mean, if you were an expert in architecture, I'm sure you could come up with some criticisms of this. And you could, it's not quite... It's too derivative or something. But, you know, to a layman, I think this just looks pleasant. I think this is just nice. And again, far superior to anything today. Rose hates this. You know, my only affection for things like this comes from The Shining. So it's like via The Shining. Okay, I like it because it's in that film. I mean, it's not quite the right era, but still. I like it in the context of the gold, the ballroom in there. But in and of itself... I mean, it's all right. It's, again, I'm not going to moan about it. I'm not going to complain about it. I'm not going to lament that this exists. It's fine. But I just don't think it's quite as nice as what went before. That's all I'm saying. God, I don't know where... Is Auntie Den... Oh, he's back. Right. Hello, Auntie Den.
Hey, yeah, I've noticed something weird that certain mics tend to crap out at exactly an hour. I have no idea what that is. Anyhow, talking about architecture, the last style that I really like is, and I'm putting this in the chat, this is a uniquely American style. It's called Googie or sometimes Populux, or you will even occasionally hear it referred to as Jetson style.
Oh, yes. You've told me about this before. I'd never heard of it before. Now, you've sent me an AVIF or AVIF file. I don't know if... No, I don't think...
All right, here's a JPEG.
Right, thank you. Yeah, StreamYard doesn't seem to like AVIF files. Hold on a second, everyone. I'll just get this on screen for you. There we go. Right, so this is very much atomic age, 1950s, future obsessed, optimistic Americana.
Yeah, and it's even a very West Coast style. You really don't see a lot of it on the East Coast, but all over the West Coast, there are tons of remaining examples of this style. And of course, anyone who's played any of the Fallout games recognizes it. But I think it's the last architecture style I think I really still like. But then again, what is after it? What, you know, steel and glass?
Yeah, I mean, steel and glass, from the 90s onwards, I just, there's nothing I like, really, architecture. I mean, I understand, when you see a sort of contemporary, something that was built in the 2000s or 2010s, they're not all dreadful, but I mean, they're not sort of ostentatiously dreadful, some of them, but I still don't like them. There's a coldness, a blandness. I'm trying to think of an example of this to show you, but it's, I don't know the names of any buildings that I could give as examples. But yeah, glass and steel, 90s sort of stuff, it's just awful. I don't know anyone who has affection for it, to be honest. Auntie Dem?
This still says something, right? It's got what is so the triangle in the ship's logo. It's pointing off to the future, right? It's saying that we do have a future. It's saying here it is, just off screen, out there in the skies. It reminds me, in a sense, of one of those Soviet statues of Lenin pointing towards the future, right?
Yeah.
This still says something. This is an artifact of a people who believe they have a future, which is why you won't see much like this anymore. And notice, even the little sign there says never closes. Open 24 hours. What's open 24 hours anymore? But yeah, there's Lenin pointing towards the future. And you can say all you want about communism, but at least it had that idea of there is a future out there. It is optimistic. We are headed towards it no matter what.
Well, let's get to that issue, because that is quite interesting and pertinent to millennial and so on. Do you think that the left, or the, let's say, the governing regime, the governing body of thought, do you think that it has run out of ideas for the future? Because, you know, things like wokery, for example, all of that, LGBT, climate change, technocratic control systems or doing things. Is that a vision for the future, or is it a sort of pragmatic, desperate option that they're just going for because there's nothing else?
Well, okay, so science fiction as we know it didn't exist till the 19th century, right? Before that, you had fiction that was written in the present or that was written in the past, But people didn't write about the future. They didn't really think about the future that much at all. This whole thing with trying to predict the future, trying to see where our place in it would be, it's a very, very new idea. You know, it didn't come up till the early 19th century and didn't really take off till the late 19th, early 20th. But there's nothing that says that has to continue forever. I think that our, you know, elite leadership has run out of steam. You know, all they can think of is more social revolution, more rainbow flag, more get rid of Christianity and more white, and get rid of more white people and have us all be a faceless, raceless mush, not particularly believing anything in anything except Amazon Prime and DoorDash. You know, they're not going to Mars. They're not going into space. There's no more of the Star Trek vision really left. And if you don't believe that, watch what passes for modern Star Trek these days.
Well, indeed. And that's an interesting point, because it's not just that there's a lack of a vision, it's that they're persistently denigrating, like, well, ourselves, our culture. You know, it's interesting because Star Trek The Next Generation in the 80s and the 90s, I think it extended to 94 or 5, it's optimistic. And you've got Captain Picard, and they come up against all sorts of difficult situations, moral conundrum. And Picard, with his intelligence and empathy and good sense, is able to resolve these moral dilemmas again and again. And, you know, you can say that's unrealistic. It doesn't matter. Of course it's unrealistic. But the point is that that was an optimistic view, and Starfleet is not corrupt. In fact, they specifically abandoned a storyline about Starfleet being corrupt. I think at the end of the first season, they were thinking of going in that direction, and then they pulled back because it just didn't fit. It would have been an interesting storyline, but it wouldn't have fit with the Star Trek ethos, and it wouldn't have fit with the times. So that's the 80s, and then now you've got Picard, and he. I mean, I haven't seen it, I haven't watched it, I've heard a lot about it, but it seems like it's just constant deconstruction and denigration, even of him as a man, as a character. And he's constantly apologizing to, and mostly to women, again and again. Obviously, I don't want to get people down, but I'm not saying anything that we're not already aware of. But Antidem, what's your perspective on that? Because that's a very... I think it's a useful A-B comparison of Star Trek in the 80s with Picard and Star Trek in the 2020s with Picard.
Oh, I could do a whole show just about Star Trek and what it means. And because, you know, I was never a big fan of the original Star Trek vision. Deconstructing it from the left didn't make it any better. I mean, the problem is it gets into nihilism. You know, the man who sees through everything sees nothing. And you look at the 2020 Picard, you know, what are you supposed to believe in other than diversity?
Well, and I had the same thought when I was watching, I didn't watch the film, but I was aware of the final Terminator film. I've forgotten, Dark Fate. Dark Fate, yeah, with the SJW sort of lesbian woman, the part Terminator, and of course the mixed race or Hispanic replacement for John Connor, and specifically killing off John Connor, by the way. But what occurred to me was, with the SJW girl from the future, what is she fighting for? Like, what's the point? Why fight Skynet? What is it that she's defending? She presumably believes in all the bullshit that any SJW girl today believes in. I mean, the character is presumably loaded up with, well, of course I'm pro-LGBT, and of course I love immigrants and all the rest of it. So So what's she fighting for? That's what's interesting. So just something to that occurred to me there when you were talking about how they deconstruct everything and then there's nothing left. You know, what's the point at that stage?
Yeah, you know, it's the left. You know, there was a column on I think Anti-Empire at Substack a little while ago talking about why Russia is not doing as well in Ukraine as they were hoping. And what the fella said was that yes, Russia did correctly gather that America is weakened from its height years ago, but you should never underestimate the ability of the empire to just outright start wrecking stuff. You know, building stuff is tough. Building stuff is always harder than wrecking stuff. You know, you bring any little kid into a clean room and say, okay, kid, wreck this place. Just absolutely mess it up. You come back 15 minutes later and it's going to look like, you know, a hotel room Jimi Hendrix stayed in, you know, on a concert tour. You know, Led Zeppelin stayed here. But you take the same kid into a mildly dirty room and tell him, okay, kid, clean it up. And you come back 8 hours later and it's half done.
Yes, if not.
Yeah. So the American empire, which right now is the LGBT empire, it is the SJW empire. Just like any low effort people, they are still good at wrecking stuff. The left can wreck Star Trek. They can wreck the Terminator. They can wreck Star Wars. They can wreck Ukraine. They can, you know, wreck the Russian army. They still retain a strong ability to just straight up wreck stuff. And, you know, that is both what makes them terrifying and also what makes them vulnerable. Because if you can build something better and keep it from getting wrecked, you know, then you can do something they can't. You know, it's what Plato warned about with republics turning to a tyrant is that republics would eventually get so chaotic, so out of control, you know, so much crime, so much insolvency, so much degeneracy, that good people of good faith, knowing exactly what they were doing, would turn to a man on a white horse and say, okay, look, please, anything, fine, come in, be a tyrant, be Caesar, be anything you want to be, just make the chaos stop. And that's, I guess, kind of what we're looking for now.
Yeah. Obviously, we're in a stage where there is so much destruction. And I think a lot of people, probably just a few years ago, SJWs, the left, probably thought there is a vision for the future. And it's a vision of equality. And it's a vision where everyone is free to live however they want. And that seems to have been, I think, diminished by COVID. I think everyone is less optimistic about the future post-COVID because it showed that, well, the same organizations and corporations who push LGBT stuff are also completely okay with being very authoritarian and nasty and reducing people's freedom and really don't care about people's welfare either. And then I think in general there's optimism has I think the optimism of the left has reduced over the last few years, and now we've got Ukraine and the resource shortages, which again I think are going to have the same effect, because you know, all of this is creeds of luxury, and if you no longer have luxury, well then you're going to have a struggle to believe in those creeds. I would think. Again, I might be proven drastically wrong on that, but that's what I think just now. So it's a sort of ironic observation that the left, which brought us to this, largely brought us to this, sorry, state, I think they're in the process of realizing now, oh shit, the corporations really aren't our friends. Because for the last 12 years or so, since Occupy, or since just after Occupy, the left have believed that Pepsi was their friend, and you know, ExxonMobil was their friend, and Shell was their friend.
Oh, I think they still believe that, and I think they're going to believe that all the way. You know, the truth about those corporations is they're amoral. They're just whores. They're just going to suck up to whoever's in power. You know, the second the left doesn't look like they're the strong horse anymore, the corporations are all going to fall away. But at the moment, they are best friends. You know, and as for the left being optimistic, I mean, one of the problems with them, and oh man, I wish I remembered who brought this up. The left has always been intentionally vague about what their ideal future looks like. They're, with a couple of exceptions, with Star Trek being one, and that's just a very particular brand of leftism. You know, the left is always super vague about, okay, what is the condition of success? What does that look like? And one of the advantages of that to them is they don't ever have to say, okay, that's it, we won. You know, it's sort of like the whole gay rights thing.
Well, and there's no victory condition as such. It just goes on and on.
Right. The whole, you know, back in the 80s, it was just, you know, we just want to be left alone to do what we want to do behind the privacy of closed doors and not bother anybody else. And, okay, that was achieved years ago. But, you know, of course, now it's drag queen story hour and, you know, transgender five-year-olds and all of that. You know, since there's never a condition of victory, they never have to declare victory, which means they can continue with the perpetual revolution.
But I agree. But they are constantly running up against human nature. And I think this is, I think that a lot of lefties are starting to feel weary with this, because their dream hasn't worked out. I mean, as you say, they've got equal rights for everyone. They've even got openly celebration for everyone. And yet still, I don't know, the SJW must be a creature who is immensely frustrated and miserable, because they're constantly disagreeing with human nature in every situation. Women keep going for strong guys. Men keep being successful, at least some of them. And the general rhythms of, you know, fundamental life remain. And I think they probably had hoped that would be destroyed, but of course it can't be.
Oh, I don't think they are. I think, you know, for example, that's the whole thing with, you know, transgenders being the modern hero of the left, is that in the view of the left, these are people who have completely conquered and transcended biology and human nature with the power of their minds. And, you know, if you can do that, you can do anything.
Yeah, I suppose so. But again, it seems to me that this is not a joyful project anymore. I mean, I can understand someone in the 80s or the 90s going on a gay pride march and thinking, yeah, we're all going to be happy and whatever. But the trans stuff is so dark, especially with the combination with children. I mean, for fuck's sake. And then, of course, the operations that they do. But especially the children thing. And I don't know, I've said this before, I don't know why they have specifically linked it with children when they didn't need to do that. But they have very specifically linked it with that. It's not about some old guy or some, you know, a 40-year-old deciding, I'm going to transition. Not even about someone in their 20s doing it. It's fucking kids. It's children.
Because they need whatever moral rule you've got, they need to transgress it. Anything that Christianity says is bad, they need to do. They need to wreck it. Wreck it in every possible way. They are out to wreck your shit. Whether your shit is Christianity or the Western civilization, which are pretty much the same thing, they are out to wreck your shit. And they're not going to stop. Because they always view themselves as the underdog. To them, they, you know, this is 1943 and they're in, you know, bad German sleepaway camp. They are the eternal victims. They are always being oppressed no matter what happens. They can't get out of that mindset. They can't stop seeing themselves as the plucky rebels flying off to blow up the Death Star. The world doesn't make sense to them any other way. And the thing about the left is they believe in magic, in that they believe that you can overcome human nature, the nature of the world, the nature of the universe, God, biology, all of it with the power of your mind. And so that's what they're going to do.
So you think that the transhumanist thing is really going to be pushed in the future? Like, they're not going to fail. They're not going to, it's just going to really be pushed.
Well, I mean, that is one very specific shard of leftism. You know, I think people make more of it than they, you know, than it's really. Then it seems more important to us than it does to the average leftist. I don't think most of them really give it much of a thought.
But surely it's the epitome of what you were talking about, the leftist push to destroy all standards and boundaries.
Yeah, yeah. But like you said, it's hard to tell what they actually believe in other than wrecking your shit.
Well, that's what I mean. You know, that eventually ceases being a joyous activity.
Oh, you not know. For them.
No.
There is nothing they like more.
I mean, I saw this clip of Justin Trudeau meeting a bunch of drag queens or something in about a month ago. And one of them, he said something like, "We've got to get away from tolerating and we've got to get to celebrating diversity of sexual orientation and whatever." And this big fat lesbian girl said, he went away and they were all talking. And this lesbian girl says, "It's so good that he acknowledged that there's more still to do. He didn't duck that."
Yeah, they will not stop. You know, speaking of the Terminator, you know,
Not stop until you transition.
yeah, basically. They absolutely will not stop until they have wrecked your shit.
Well, you know, James Cameron himself, I'm sorry to say it, but leaving aside the nonsense of Avatar, he also approved that last Terminator film. You know,
yeah.
The guy, and people did talk about a quote, he said recently that testosterone was... I think people made too much out of it. I think all he was saying was that when you're a young guy in your 20s, you've got a lot of fucking testosterone, and it makes you ballsy, literally. It makes you aggressive. It drives you, and it makes you fall out with people, but it also makes you lead. It makes you dominate others, and it helps you to get what you want, and it propels you towards getting what you want. It's useful when you're in your 20s and 30s and trying to establish yourself. But beyond that, it's kind of a relief when it wears down and you're just no longer so hyped up and horny and aggressive. You know, you're calmer. It's a relief, certainly in my own experience.
Sure, you know, so Socrates said the same thing. So, yeah, you know, and anytime somebody brings up a clickbait quote like that, you know, look into it a little bit more before you...
Yeah, I say that just to defend him from the more extreme accusations. That I don't think he was saying that testosterone is like a poison, and we've all got to purge ourselves off it. That's how people were talking about it. But having said that, the guy is a fucking feminist. And it's so ridiculous. It's when you see a guy who's very masculine and very forthright and confident, when you see a guy even like that kowtowing to feminism and being this simp, it's very annoying and disgusting, because you realize this guy does not need to do this. And indeed, women would find him a hell of a lot less attractive if he did this. Whereas if he were just fucking mad, like Mel Gibson or Clint Eastwood, I don't think they're going to say this shit. Or Jack Nicholson. And so women will continue to, even when these guys are geriatrics, women will continue to find them very appealing. Yeah, I don't know if you've got anything to say about that.
Yeah. It's, you know, too much time in Hollywood. You know, I guess this points to one thing that I really think is a big issue now, which is what I call Versailles syndrome. You know, Louis XIV built this huge palace. You ever been to Versailles?
No, I haven't, but I've seen photos of it.
Versailles is this huge, self-contained palace, complex of palaces, honestly, and grounds, and the self-contained, basically, city that Louis XIV built so he could get away from Paris and sort of rule from there. The problem is that it became, you know, all the nobles from around France all gravitated there, basically moved within this walled city. And before too long, there was this huge disconnect between what was important inside the walls of Versailles and what everyone thought was important outside of the walls of Versailles. And there were a lot of people who made sure that there was not much communication going back and forth. So, you know, Louis thought what was important was winning the war with England and, whose wife was sneaking off into whose bed. And the dastardly palace intrigues of the Marquis de so-and-so. And nobody outside the walls cared about that. They all cared about, you know, our crops are failing.
It's kind of funny. It reminds me of how no one cares about beefs between e-celebs.
Yeah, well. But, you know, you see this, saw the same thing with the Winter Palace of the Tsar, with the Forbidden City in China. You know, everything that the Emperor of China thought was important in 1910 was completely unimportant to anyone outside the walls, and, you know, vice versa. And that in many cases, the king or the emperor didn't even know what was important to the people. We're certainly getting there in America with Washington, D.C.
Well, you know, when Biden first moved into the White House and they had it all, it looked like they had the army there and all that, the big fence. And it just seemed to be the epitome of this cliche of the government that is not just detached from the people, but utterly contemptuous and fearful of them, that the hordes will storm the palace kind of thing.
Well, there's a definite inside the walls, and it's not quite exactly like the old one, because it's not quite as bound by geography. Here it's inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C., or Manhattan, or Los Angeles, or Silicon Valley, or the Twitter blue checks. And that's what has them going absolutely bonkers about Elon Musk buying Twitter. It's that he's letting the commoners inside the walled palace. And suddenly they might have to hear what's important to the peasants, which they couldn't care less about. Really nobody outside the palace walls gives a shit about Ukraine. I mean, maybe they did for a couple of months when the war first started. Nobody cares about that. All of these issues that seem so important to our political class, it's like, do you guys even understand how little that matters to anyone outside your Versailles? I've heard City of London is basically the same thing. Brussels is basically, you know, the EU infrastructure is basically the same thing. And the problem with that is it has a tendency to not go on forever.
Yes, yes, definitely. I mean, you wonder how it will end, how it will be resolved. But I do think that this detachment of the elite, this complete disregard and disinterest for what ordinary people are concerned about and what and their needs, you know, the need that people have for a future, if not a societal vision, then at least they want to know that their life will be okay, that there's a framework in place. And I think, you know, even in the 80s and 90s, you could still believe that. But now, no. Now, that's a big change that's happened in my adulthood.
Well, you know, certainly, again, like with the Ukraine war, I wonder how long people in Western Europe are going to shiver in the dark before they decide they've had enough.
Well, absolutely. This is what I keep wondering. How long is this going to go on? I mean, some people think that the public will just take anything and they'll actually become more servile as they become more deprived. Others think there'll be a peasant's revolt sort of thing. I mean, I'm certainly not advocating that. I'm just talking about this as a matter of intellectual curiosity.
Oh, a peaceful, pleasant peasant revolt with people in the streets with protest signs, you know. I wouldn't mind seeing that.
Yeah, absolutely. As long as it was mostly peaceful, at least. Okay. Well, on that note, I guess we can wrap up. I am supposed to be doing the Christmas card stream around that. I mean, it doesn't matter if it gets delayed. We're having a perfectly interesting conversation, so I don't want to end it prematurely. But I will put some questions to you. So here they are.
Oh, wait, before you do, one question for you is, did you get the Christmas card I sent?
Well, I don't know. I'll have a look when I open them, and I'm going to do that just in the next stream. Okay. So,
and I think I might have put my real return address on it, so, you know, be a little careful with that.
Yes, someone else had the same concern, and I will endeavor to keep that, you know, the actual envelopes out of the camera. I'm not actually sure how I'm going to do it yet. I think I'll set the Wii webcam up on the bendy tripod thing. Incidentally, here's a tip for anyone who's starting or thinking about getting into this: get one of those bendy tripod things because they are incredibly useful, along with a Zoom H2N microphone, which Antidem was the one who recommended that to me in the first place, and now I recommend it to everyone who'll listen to me.
So, very good.
Mm. Oh yeah. So I'm afraid I don't know yet whether your card arrived because they all went to a PO box and then from there they were posted to me at my real address. So I haven't seen them yet. But right. Anyway, thank you for sending me a card. I do appreciate that. Okay. Now, Black Pigeon Pilled asks, can Antidem and Woz confirm whether the films In Bruges and Die Hard are Christmas films?
Like I said, my go-to Christmas film is Scrooged.
Scrooged? Okay. Well, I haven't seen In Bruges. I've seen Die Hard, but that was a long time ago. And I don't associate it with Christmas. I think they would have had to, you know, include it, feature it in the film a bit more prominently if they wanted people to think of it as a Christmas film. So I'd have to say no to that. It's kind of like how a tomato is technically a fruit, but no one actually thinks of it in that way. You know, it just doesn't work. All right, so Ecorn says, this is the average price of one cubic meter of gaseous gas here. Well, so, okay, thank you for that. Aristocratico says, J-rock is a very common term within Japan right now. So to say rock and roll is a feature of the Anglosphere is a little off.
Again, I'm quite the Japanophile. I've lived there for a while. I've traveled there a lot. I'm really familiar with J-rock. And that whole thing I say, again, it's not that another culture can't produce something that came from, not that culture B can't produce something that came from culture A, it's that it's always going to be a copy. It's always going to be derivative. It's never going to be particularly original, and they can't really build on it. So, yeah, J-Rock, I mean, at its best, it's a copy of stuff that came out of the Anglosphere, you know, but when you look at the real creative energy behind rock and roll, and again, with the notable exception of Nordics and heavy metal, you know, everyone from Germany north, yeah, they can do metal. But with the notable exception of that, rock and roll is an Anglosphere thing.
Yeah, I think that's simply true. Even if other cultures have their own variant of it, it's obviously intrinsically an Anglosphere thing. All right, Monty Fontaine asks, do you remember doing someone a mixtape? I don't think I ever did make mixtapes. No, maybe I did. I've forgotten. I don't know. Antidem, did you ever make mixtapes?
Maybe anime music mixtapes, but not other than that.
Right. Okay. Well, that's a rather disappointing answer for Monty Fontaine. Sorry about that. Lady of Shalott says, some of these monstrosity houses and buildings make Minecraft houses look like they were designed by Sir Christopher Wren. They were built to destroy the human spirit, and they have. It's a very indignant comment there. I think you're right. But the thing is, I think, see, again, if you look at Alexander Road, that was designed by an architect called I think his name was Airy Neave. Hold on a minute, let me just make sure of that. And not Airy Neave. He was the guy who got assassinated by the IRA. Damn it! Hold on a second. Let me just get this right. Neave Brown. That was it. Sorry, everyone. So it was designed by an architect called Neave Brown, and I've seen interviews with him. I've read a lot about him. And I genuinely think that he was trying to create something that worked for people. And I don't think he hated people. Apparently, he was well known to the residents of the estate for decades afterwards. He would visit. He liked it. He moved into a different estate that he himself designed. I've forgotten the name of that one. So he lived in his own, in the architecture that he designed. I mean, this is the cliche. It's like how Andy Warhol had a lot of classical art. He collected a lot of classical paintings while he created shit. And I really don't like Andy Warhol's stuff. And it's similar with the architects, how they'll live in some lovely Victorian mansion or whatever while designing dreadful stuff for everyone else to live in. But in the case of Neave Brown, he absolutely wasn't trying to destroy the human spirit. Now, as for Thames Mead, I don't know who designed that. I can't remember. And I think it was a set of architects who did that. And, well, yeah, I mean, a lot of them were communists and, you know, not very nice people, not very well-intentioned. And I wouldn't be surprised if you're correct about them, that they literally wanted to destroy the people who would have to live in the projects that they designed.
Well, that's very sick. That's very James Howard Kunstler. And Jim is, you know, he's right that there are human hostile environments out there. And whether they were designed intentionally to be that way or not, you know, some misfires are completely well-intentioned, but that doesn't make them not misfires. And as for the Lady of Shalott, all I have to say is, willows white and aspens shiver, the sunbeam showers break and quiver, in the stream that runneth ever by the island in the river flowing down to Camelot. Four gray walls and four gray towers overlook a space of flowers, and the silent isle embowers the Lady of Shalott.
How romantic. That's lovely. Okay, and then Black Pigeon Pilled says, if you have time, try and find the VOD of Trudeau, please, Wars. It was two different things. The one from about a month ago was the drag queen, where it was a sort of ridiculous thing. But the other one, I think the one that you might be referring to, is from about, it was from Pride Month, from about 6 months ago, and he was saying the same thing, actually. He was saying, it's so wonderful to see everyone here celebrating. Just fucking absurd. And I'm sure you can find it if you want. It was, you know, Pride Month or Pride Week, whatever they do in Canada, this year. So it should be. And I did post it on my Telegram, but I've forgotten. I couldn't find it when I tried to track it down the other night. So sorry. I mean, really, any clip of Trudeau is going to be equally agonizing. The guy is a complete... I mean, it's not even fair to call him an idiot. There's something missing there. There's something missing from him. He's not quite...
The boy ain't right.
Well, yeah, he's just not as a man should be. There's something wrong. And I don't mean that he's mental. I mean that, you know, spiritually speaking, there's just something wrong with him. All right, Black Pigeon Pilled also says, does Anti-Dem support the SSPX and Bishop Williamson? He has appeared on several streams, and I find the concept of sedevacantism curious. So, Anti-Dem?
Do you ever see that old Chris Rock comedy routine, OJ, I understand? That's kind of my attitude towards SSPX. It's like, I can't say that I approve of it, but I understand.
Right. Yes, I think I get it. All right. And then Caesar himself says, just throwing some appreciation for all these great streams. Merry Christmas and a special cheers to my fellow traveler, Black Pigeon Pilled. Well, thank you very much, Caesar himself. That is appreciated. All right. Well, I guess, is there anything... Why don't you tell us, in a fond manner, what Christmas means to you, Anti-Dem? Just as a way to finish on a nice, heartwarming note. Things that you like about Christmas.
No.
Please?
It's family... personal history. I'm not a Christmas guy.
Oh, that's unfortunate. Right,
okay. I'll tell you all the things I love about Halloween, but just me and Christmas, not on great terms.
Well, then why do you like these versions of A Christmas Carol?
A good movie here and there. It's not like I watch them a lot. What do I hate about Christmas?
No, don't tell me what you hate about Christmas. I don't want to get people down.
Okay. I won't tell you. I'll just say, any of you who are on here, if you go to YouTube and you look up Oscar the Grouch, I Hate Christmas, there's Oscar the Grouch's I Hate Christmas song from the Sesame Street Christmas in 1978. And that's pretty much how I feel about Christmas. So,
even though you are a traditionalist Catholic commentator.
Yeah. Easter. I'm all about the Easter, but, you know, yeah.
All right. Well, I'll stop pushing, but I thought you would have something nice to say. I mean, you must like the trees or the lights or the colors or the winter, the weather. There must be something you like, surely.
What's the similarity between Oscar the Grouch and Justin Trudeau?
I don't know.
They both love it in the can.
Okay. All right, then. Well, in that case, I will give up.
Oh, but, wait, hold on. Yeah. We have the best comment ever. The Sasquatch just posted it. Just logging in. This guy is a fag. Bye.
Well, that's not true. Anti-Dem is a nice guy. And indeed, when I went to America, it was Anti-Dem who met me off the plane and introduced me to that wondrous land of opportunity and adventure. So I'm always grateful for that. All right. Auntie Dem, if there's anything that you'd like to say to people to leave them on an upbeat note?
Yeah, these conversations are always fun. You know, I wouldn't mind if you invited me for a few more of them sprinkled throughout the year.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, I'm definitely going to have to change the whole format of what I do, because my weekly show became very onerous with editing and stuff this year. So I think next year I'll just put them up freshly, fairly raw on Odyssey. Because I want to do other things. You know, it was taking too long, too much time. And I want to produce more stuff. I want to, and, you know, of different kinds as well. I want to get into creative writing and all that kind of thing. So I think what I would like to do is, more live stream content. We'll see. I did have an idea for something, so we'll see if that works out. In the meantime, there will be change next year, so that's nice. But in the meantime, I do enjoy these streams at Millennial, and it's always nice to have Auntie Dem on. So thank you for appearing.
Thank you much.
All right. Well, I'll be back imminently, maybe in about 10 minutes, with the Christmas card stream. I'll have to set up the camera, so there might be a bit of delay, 10-15 minutes, and then that will be something quite unique, so we'll see how it goes. In the meantime, Auntie Dem, thank you for appearing on Millennial 8.
My pleasure.
Okay, I'll see you all soon. Bye-bye.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. Bidding on this year's NFT ends on the 30th. It's your chance to own this one-of-a-kind commemorative piece, lovingly hand-coded by Millennial Woes himself. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.